welcome again to another episode. It's episode 25 for March 20th, 2007. We're going to be talking today about movies. What a shock. And we're going to get started by talking about the Wilhelm Scream, a great bit of sound effect that I guarantee you've heard before, but maybe didn't realize. We'll have a trivia question for you. Sam is going to begin talking about the history of animation in the movies in the first of a multi-part industry trend look at animation. Our top six list is going to be on stars we hated but now like. So these are guys that we one time didn't like but now really do. And we're going to spotlight a great film that's really kind of underseen, maybe a little underappreciated, called The Red Violin. And if that title makes you running to go watch a Bruce Willis movie, maybe you shouldn't, because it's significantly more interesting than, you know, a violin might make you think. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I'm Sam Stoddard, and Bruce Willis movie, The Red Violin has Samuel L. Jackson. That's way cooler.
Okay, you got that. That's true.
Yeah, that is true, isn't it? All right, well, what happened last week? This is a great episode. You introduced yourself, and there was this moment of weird silence, and I didn't get it. What was all that about?
Exactly.
I think we should do a joke this week. A guy named Sheb Woolley had a number one pop hit, Purple People Eater. Remember that song? Well, he also wrote the theme song for Hee Haw, but arguably his biggest contribution to show business was for screaming. Sheb Woolley screamed, and this was recorded and used as a sound effect in the 1951 film Distant Drums, a western starring Gary Cooper. Specifically, it was used at a point in the movie where a soldier gets bitten by an alligator and pulled underwater. Well, this sound effect got filed into the Warner Brothers sound effects library and was reused in several movies, like The Charge at Feather River in 53, Them, that giant ant movie, in 54, Helen of Troy from 56, and The Green Berets from 68. In A Star is Born from 1954, it's heard twice. Once because The Charge at Feather River is playing within the movie, and it's that scene. Well, a sound designer named Ben Burt picked up on how this one scream was showing up in all these different movies, and it was him who gave the scream its name, the Wilhelm Scream, so named because that's the name of the character who screams in The Charge at Feather River. So now you know what is meant by Wilhelm Scream, which is this week's term in our growing film buff's dictionary. So when Ben Burt was hired to do the sound effects for Star Wars, he was able to rummage through the sound libraries at other studios, and while at Warner Brothers, he ran across the original sound effect filed under Man Getting Bit by an Alligator and He Screams. That was the name of the effect. And as the effect had already sort of become an in-joke with him and some of his friends who noticed this scream getting used and used, he had to use it in Star Wars, and he used it in the scene where the stormtrooper falls down the bottomless hole, you know, the part where Luke and Leia swing across. There's prior to that, a stormtrooper falls in the hole, and he uses the Wilhelm scream. And so began this big in-joke. Burt later used it in all six Star Wars movies, plus the Star Wars Christmas special, all three Indiana Jones movies, and Willow. And one of his friends who was in on this joke early on was sound editor Richard Anderson, and he continued the tradition in Poltergeist, Batman Returns, and Madagascar, the animated movie from a couple of years ago. And so it's just spreading like wildfire. You've almost certainly heard this same scream many, many times and not known it. It appears in 130 movies plus as of this recording. Some others are The Wild Bunch, Explorers, Howard the Duck, Spaceballs, Beauty and the Beast, Aladdin, Reservoir Dogs, Toy Story, Die Hard with a Vengeance, The Fifth Element, Spider-Man, Lord of the Rings, The Two Towers, and Return of the King, Pirates of the Caribbean, Kill Bill, Sin City, Wallace and Gromit, X-Men The Last Stand, Cars, Monster House, I mean, even things like Monster in Law, you know, that romantic comedy, I guess, with Jane Fonda and Jennifer Lopez recently, and Anchorman. I mean, these are things that you wouldn't expect would require a man bitten by alligator sound effect, but it's in there. So obviously this is a very versatile sound effect, and it goes like this. So I could go up to Steven and shoot him in the gut, and he'd go, or we could be duking it out on a rickety rope bridge, and I'd punch him, and he'd go, and I'd chop off his arm, and he'd go, and then I'd chop off his other arm, and he'd go, and then he'd fall into the canyon and he'd go, and then alligators would eat him up and he'd go, and there are other, you know, oft-reused sound effects. Steven, are you up for any more? That was quite a bit of punishment there.
Ow. Oh, man.
Well, anyway, there are other sound effects that maybe aren't quite as painful, like this one, which is called Castle Thunder, originally recorded for Frankenstein in 1931 and used in, innumerable films. Probably every single peal of thunder in every movie from 1931 to the mid-80s or so is the Castle Thunder effect. It's the same recording in every movie. Everything from Citizen Kane to Sleeping Beauty, even Back to the Future, when the clock tower gets zapped by lightning, used this effect. And seemingly the only reason it was stopped being used is for fidelity. The quality of the recording just wasn't up to improving standards of sound recording as time went on, so it fell into disuse eventually. But that's a good 50 years when it was in a lot of movies. And here's another sound effect. You've heard that one in just about every movie or TV show produced by Universal in the 70s and 80s. The A-Team, Magnum P.I., The $6 Million Man. Every episode of The Rockford Files opens with that sound of the phone ringing. It's the same recording. It even dates back to Leave It to Beaver. And in the movies, it was in Ghostbusters and Close Encounters of the Third Kind and The Sting and Tootsie and a bunch of others. Finally, there's the cry of the red-tailed hawk, and I couldn't find the actual recording, but it goes a bit like this. And that's pretty close to the original sound effect, but that's also used in many, many films, although strangely, often used to voice eagles rather than hawks, so a lot of people recognize the difference and the disconnect there. But if you just have a desertscape, then maybe you'd have that sound to give it a little bit of atmosphere. But the Wilhelm scream is just a wonderful little inside joke in the history of movies. On our website, allmovietalk.com, we'll link to the filmography of the Wilhelm scream, which is growing by a good 10 movies every year now, and also a video that's out there that compiles together a bunch of clips of uses of the scream in various movies, so you can actually see where it occurs in a bunch of these different movies. It's interesting stuff. The Sorcerer's Apprentice segment in Fantasia, of course, stars Mickey Mouse, who puts on the sorcerer's hat and gets into a lot of trouble with brooms and water buckets. It was Walt Disney's idea to use Mickey Mouse in this sequence. The writer of the segment had a different idea. This week's trivia question is to name the also-famous Disney character that the writer originally wanted to use instead of Mickey Mouse. Starting right now, we're going to be covering the history of animation in the movies in our industry trend segment. This week, we'll be talking about the birth of animation and how it blossomed into a commercial art form. But let's start by defining what animation is. I think most of us know what animation is when we see it. Basically, if you have a series of static images, each one a little different than the one before, and you show them in rapid progression, it tricks our eyes into seeing movement. Well, basically, that's animation. But if you think about it, all movies are like that. Every movie ever made, at least the visual component, is a series of static images that convey the illusion of movement. So what's going to be the distinguishing feature of animation is that each frame gets produced individually. Whether you're drawing a picture for each frame or taking a picture of molded clay for each frame or whatever, it's animation if you produce each frame individually. Even if you use a computer to interpolate for you and fill in a bunch of missing frames automatically, computer animation is still basically centered around frame-by-frame construction. Obviously, creating a movie frame-by-frame tends to be a whole lot of work. And in fact, it's surprising that animated movies even exist because they tend to be very expensive to make and can take quite a long time. Today, 3 years and $100 million to make an animated movie isn't that uncommon. But you can do some amazing things with animation, largely because you are unbound from real life. Anything you can draw can be animated. Anything you can mold out of clay can be animated. So the limit is really just the imagination, whereas in live-action films, we're only really just getting to the stage where anything we can imagine can be put on film, and that's thanks largely to computer animation looking like real life. The first instance of animation on film is generally considered to be a short called Humorous Phases of Funny Faces from 1906 by James Stewart Blackton. And in this, a camera is aimed at a chalkboard, and there's some puppetry involved, which is not animation, but there's also some animation achieved through a series of chalk drawings shot frame by frame. The inspiration for this was probably a kind of old vaudeville routine they had at the time, where a fast series of sketches would be drawn in front of an audience. Not quite the same type of thing, of course, but anyway, you can actually watch this short film for free online at the Library of Congress, and we'll put a link to that on our website, allmovietalk.com. The first fully animated movie is probably Phantasmagorie by the French animator Émile Cole, who is part of a movement in art called the Incoherent Movement, which was interested in nightmares and absurdism and often expressed in the style of children's drawings. But Phantasmagorie is just 2 minutes long, but it's animated the whole way through, and basically it's a series of strange, you know, stream-of-consciousness type of imagery, largely about things transforming into other things, like a house turning into an elephant and that kind of thing. And probably the next major animator is named Winsor McCay, who makes a 10-minute film called Little Nemo in 1911, with James Stewart Blackton actually directing live-action portions. But McCay is the animator here, and he really comes into his own with Gertie the Dinosaur in 1914. If you are on the animation scene, you have probably heard of Gertie the Dinosaur, which is probably the first great cartoon. It holds up very well today, and it's a real breakthrough for character animation. The idea of creating actual characters through animation and telling interesting stories with them rather than having just fun little imagery. It's made up of 10,000 drawings, Gertie the Dinosaur, done in ink on rice paper and mounted on cardboard. And this is actually a whole lot more work than later techniques required because each frame was drawn from scratch. Later on, animators would use what's called cells, which are essentially transparencies, so you could redraw the moving parts of the frame and reuse the background. But McCay redrew everything, including the very detailed backgrounds for every frame of Gertie the Dinosaur. Cell animation, by the way, was invented by Earl Hurd, who patented the process this same year, 1914.
Now, a question about the Gertie the Dinosaur. Since the backgrounds are being redrawn each time, how do they... I mean, it's impossible to completely draw it exact, isn't it? Do they appear to shift around?
Yeah, there's a little bit of... Because when you draw a line, you know, it might have rough edges in a different way as the previous. So there's a little bit of liveliness to the background that you wouldn't expect to see.
Interesting.
It does have an effect on the animation style. Yeah. So another noteworthy work of McCay's is The Sinking of the Lusitania from 1918, and this time he did use cells. And the film is significant because it's the first time we see animation done in the service of a political message. The film depicts the attack on the Lusitania and serves as wartime propaganda. Of course, by the time it was finished, World War I was already over. So it just goes to show that the time it takes to produce animation has a couple of drawbacks. Incidentally, all of McCay's surviving work, including the three cartoons I've mentioned so far, are available on an excellent DVD. Amazon and Netflix both carry it. There are a couple of different editions, though. You want the one called Winsor McCay, The Master Edition. That one has the best transfers of the films. But let's backtrack briefly to 1915. One, Max Fleischer patents the rotoscoping process, which is where you achieve animation by taking live-action footage and tracing over it. So you get authentic shapes, but stylized colors and textures. This is just another technique of many, and he used it throughout his work, which includes his Coco the Clown series and also for animating Cab Calloway dance routines for use in the Betty Boop cartoons, but we'll get to those later. I should also mention that in 1915, the live-action Birth of a Nation is released, which is usually considered the first important feature-length film, and it introduces a lot of the fundamentals of filmmaking techniques that we still use today. I mention this just to give you a frame of reference here, because basically, the development of animation happens only a step or two behind the development of live-action film itself. So we're really talking way early before movies had really defined themselves and people had really discovered all the potential of the medium. And the first animated feature film is just around the corner. It was directed by the Argentinian filmmaker and I'm just going to mess this up, I guess, but it looks like Quirino Cristiani, who used cardboard cutouts for animation. And in 1916, he made a political satire called El Apostol, and it's about the Argentinian president Irigoyen, or something, who wants to purge the corruption and crime from Buenos Aires by ascending into heaven and using Jupiter's thunderbolts to shoot them down and basically incinerate the whole city in the process. So obviously,
now, was that based on a true event?
Yeah, I think it was, yeah. Well, it was. It was a political satire, using symbolism to get the point across, but Cristiani would also make the world's second animated feature in 1918 called Leaving No Trace, and the first animated feature with sound in 1931 called Pedulopolis or something. All of these were political satires. Unfortunately, all three have been lost to fire, maybe started by Jupiter's thunderbolts or something. Anyway, the work of the German silent animator Lotte Reiniger had a happier fate. Her work achieves animation through silhouettes, taking cardboard cutouts and casting shadows onto hand-drawn backgrounds and using color tinting to get really bright, lush colors. It's actually a lot more beautiful and elegant than maybe it sounds. I'm not sure if it sounds that exciting or not, but there are some gorgeous shapes and colors in her work. And after a few short films, starting in 1919, she starts work on a feature film in 1923 called The Adventures of Prince Ahmed, completed 3 years later in 1926. The storylines are drawn from the Arabian Nights tales, and the good news is that this film does survive. It's the oldest surviving animated feature, and you can buy it on DVD or rent it from Netflix, and I would definitely urge you to do that if you're interested in animation, especially the history of animation. It's certainly an important work, and it's a big success at the time, too. But animation in the 1920s is primarily about short cartoons, which take the lead from Gertie the Dinosaur and develop comic characters that the audience can get to know. Most popular cartoon character in the 20s is Felix the Cat. You probably recognize the name even if you've never seen a Felix the Cat cartoon. It's unclear as to who actually created the character, but he comes out of a New York animation studio owned by Pat Sullivan. And Felix the Cat, like a lot of movie stars from the silent era, falls out of popularity with the advent of sound. I guess his real-life voice just couldn't cut it. But he does get revived in the 1950s on television. Probably second in popularity to Felix the Cat is Max Fleischer's rotoscoped Coco the Clown that I mentioned earlier. And also we see Walt Disney, the most famous name in animation to this day, probably. He's just getting started. He and his friend Ub Iwerks start dabbling with animation in 1920, and in 1924, they start making the Alice comedies about a live-action girl named Alice and an animated cat named Julius. And this series runs until 1927, when they sort of shift their attention over to a new character, Oswald the Rabbit, who's pretty much the prototype for Mickey Mouse. A while into the series, Universal, the distributing studio, takes control of the character away and gives him to other animators, and so that's why Walt Disney went on to create a new character, Mickey Mouse, that he couldn't have the ownership to. The Walt Disney Company would later reacquire the rights to Oswald the Rabbit, but interestingly, not until 2006. So it took quite a while to come full circle. By the way, you know how I mentioned animation takes a long time? Well, you do save a lot of time with a team of animators and a real streamlined process and minimalistic drawing. So there's ways you can cut corners or turn it into a more of an assembly line and really crank them out. There were actually somewhere around 150 Felix the Cat cartoons and 250 Oswald cartoons. They really got to cranking these things out pretty quickly. Anyway, Disney and Iwerks go off together on their own and create Mickey Mouse in 1928, and Mickey Mouse becomes basically the most famous animated character in the world. One of the world's most recognized symbols, in fact, the two ears. The first Mickey Mouse cartoon was called Plain Crazy, and the second called The Galloping Gaucho, and the third is the hugely famous Steamboat Willie, which is another name you will recognize probably even if you haven't seen the cartoon. Steamboat Willie is generally thought of as the first sound cartoon. It isn't quite. That would be Dinner Time by animator Paul Terry, but Steamboat Willie is definitely the first successful sound cartoon and really hugely successful. And it kicked off a series of short cartoons starring Mickey Mouse and also Donald Duck and Goofy and all those until 1953. Many of them are great, in fact. Today, though, the character is used more as a symbol than an actual character, but he does appear occasionally in special features now and again. In parallel with Disney's character-oriented cartoons, Disney was also producing the Silly Symphonies, which are these animated sequences set to music, starting with Skeleton Dance in 1929. The Silly Symphonies were all about pioneering the art of sound in movies and using pre-recorded music, usually popular tunes of the day, and synchronizing it to the picture. A noteworthy entry in the series is the 1932 short Flowers and Trees, which was the first commercial three-strip Technicolor film, even preceding live-action three-strip Technicolor. And the Silly Symphonies series lasts until 1939 and establishes the precedent for the 1940 feature film Fantasia, which kind of functions like an upscale series of Silly Symphony cartoons all stitched together. There's 9 different segments set to classical music and stitched together into a feature. Some aficionados of music have their problems with Fantasia on the grounds that it makes edits to the pieces of music featured in the movie, but in terms of animation and visualizing music on film, it's a masterpiece, an absolutely incredible achievement, and the earliest prominent instance of animation being used to create, you know, not just comedy or even storytelling, but beauty. It's a very beautiful film, and this would sort of be what distinguishes Disney animation from the other animation studios of the day, just in general. Disney was a lot more refined and elegant and beautiful than the other animation studios, and this style, you know, it really emphasizes actually not just of the images themselves, but beauty in the movements. But let's backtrack to 1930, because this is when the other great classic cartoon studio starts coming together, and that's the Warner Brothers cartoons, the Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies, which initially starts out as an independent entity owned by Leon Schlesinger that Warner hires to produce cartoons for them. And then in 1944, he sells everything to Warner, so Warner produces the cartoons itself after that. But, you know, I'm going to gloss over the development of these particular cartoons because we'll be featuring them in their own series of segments in the weeks to come. But just as a frame of reference, the first Looney Tune was made in 1930, a year after Steamboat Willie. Porky Pig, the first of the Looney Tunes star characters we know today, didn't come around until 1935, 5 years later. Daffy Duck in 1937, and Bugs Bunny, the big one, in 1940. And this series of Looney Tunes runs all the way up until 1969 and is still revived on occasion. So throughout the 30s, we have Mickey Mouse and the Looney Tunes building up their, you know, the enduring fame and respect that they'll ultimately accrue. But there's a third, maybe equally popular cartoon studio at the time, active in the 1930s that didn't age as well, and that's one I mentioned before, the Max Fleischer Studio. Fleischer, who is already successful in the 20s with Coco the Clown, starts producing the Betty Boop cartoons in 1930, and he would also produce the Popeye cartoon starting in 1933, and the Superman cartoon starting in 1941. But Betty Boop is in a class all of her own, and weird, oddly enduring for a character very tied to her time. Actually, not even tied to the 30s so much as the 20s, because she's a flapper girl, just 16 years old, actually, and based on actress Helen Kane by way of Clara Bow. But Kane's signature phrase was boop-oop-ba-doop well before Betty Boop borrowed it. Well, that's a tongue twister. But now, if you hear boop-oop-ba-doop, then, of course, it's Betty Boop. And these cartoons, especially earlier on, are a bit more mature than the other cartoons of the day, although it's a mistake to say most cartoons were aimed at children, because they weren't. The Looney Tunes animators, for example, were always answered the question, you know, you make these films for children, right? And said, no, well, we make them for ourselves. But Betty Boop is a bit more risque, tame by today's standards, but certainly not tame at the time. And I think a critical component to her popularity, though, is that while the cartoons themselves may be more provocative and have a more mature sensibility, she herself is not. She's an innocent character. And so she finds herself running across lecherous villains that, you know, keep trying to stalk her or catch her or peek at her when she's changing or whatever, but she never invites that on herself. And ultimately she wins the upper hand without compromising her values. And so Betty Boop becomes a character that we can like and not be threatened by, and audiences of the day just loved her. But, you know, when the Hays Production Code went into effect in the mid-30s, this would be the precursor to the MPAA ratings we have today, basically a censor board. These cartoons had to be toned down, and Betty Boop went quickly out of fashion. But her popularity keeps reviving. The old cartoons were unearthed for television in the 50s, and she was really popular during the 60s counterculture movement. And even today, there's this big market for merchandising and collectibles and stuff. Well, in the 1940s, both Looney Tunes and Disney cartoons really come into their own. I think it's easy to forget, now that these characters have been mostly just icons for 50-plus years, that the actual short cartoons are just great as art, as well as entertainment. And we also see Woody Woodpecker and Droopy and Tom and Jerry starting to surface and having really good long runs. Because in the theaters at the time, you went to the theater, you always saw a short cartoon before the advanced feature. And so there's a high demand. In front of every movie, you had to have a cartoon. So these studios were kept in pretty good business until that just absolutely disappeared with the advent of television. But as a kid, Tom and Jerry was my absolute favorite cartoon. I mean, they're definitely from a time when people didn't mind bloodless cartoon violence so much. Jerry's always whacking Tom over the head and sawing him in half or whatever, but it's all in good fun. It's not a realistic depiction of violence, but people get all wussy about that in later decades. You know, just get over it. I mean, there's nothing wrong with this kind of fooling around, and the kids certainly know the difference between real violence and cartoon violence. But as I say, in the 1960s, it was when theatrical short cartoons fall out of fashion, along with the newsreel and live-action shorts. These are all forms that we just don't use today, and that's because we have television. We can get all these things on television, so animation largely moves to TV, and especially in 1960, when The Flintstones kicks off as a prime-time animation show. It's the first animated television series with wholly original animation. There were a couple that preceded it that were just repackaged theatrical short cartoons, but you know, The Flintstones is a huge hit, and suddenly people are rushing to produce animation for television. Unfortunately, the weekly pace of an animated show required a lot of cutting of corners. And in any case, we start to see animation being geared more and more towards children only around this time. And so there just isn't as much need for the cartoons to maintain the level of quality and appeal that would satisfy more critical tastes of adults. So, you know, unfortunately, animation becomes relegated to bad television, and it just spirals downward in quality for the next several decades. I mean, there are exceptions here and there. But even fondly remembered cartoons like Scooby-Doo and G.I. Joe and Transformers, I think, have more appeal as nostalgia than, you know, actually good shows. But the good news is that animation and feature films during this time fares a bit better, as Disney dominates the feature animation scene for decades and produces a remarkable series of classics. And there's a real animation boom in the 90s that gets results in the reemergence of actual competition from other animation studios. But that's a huge amount of time that Disney was dominating. Next week, we're going to talk a bit about the process of animation, how new technologies have come about to streamline the animation process, and how computers have opened the door to a whole new form of animation. And in the weeks beyond that, we'll be taking a closer look at the Disney films and the Warner Brothers cartoons, so definitely don't miss that. In the meantime, check out the show notes for this episode on our website, allmovietalk.com, and we'll provide you with links to where you can see some of the cartoons we've talked about for free online, and also point you toward good DVD compilations and other reference material.
We've talked before on our top six lists about movies that were surprisingly good, movies we expected not to like but did. But one another interesting kind of related thing to that is the idea of stars that we didn't like at one point that we do now. I think especially a lot of recent stars, maybe the first couple of things you see them in, it's first impressions are everything. And you don't like that movie, you don't like that role, you have a bad impression about that actor or actress or that director or writer or whomever. And I think that it's interesting how our perceptions of them change. So today's top six list, it's all about stars that we didn't like at one point, but now do. And we should just credit this to listener The
fan whose father actually suggested we do a top six list on most improved actor. And I don't know if this is going to fall that exactly, because maybe some of these have to do with our perceptions as much as the actor or actress, but... Anyway, my number six entry is Will Smith. Now, I remember growing up with Will Smith as the Fresh Prince and the rapper and that TV show, and when he started making movies, I was like, okay, I'm not really that interested in seeing the Fresh Prince try and be an actor. Especially, I think it's hard when musicians, period, try and transition into acting, because a lot of times they just don't do it well. And Will Smith's first couple of roles, you know, movies like Independence Day and stuff, you know, these sort of big blockbustery movies, I don't know, I didn't really have much appreciation for him. But over the last couple of years, I think, just as I see more and more of him, I have to agree that he's really a bona fide movie star with a lot of charisma and a surprisingly good selection of scripts recently. I particularly like this year's Pursuit of Happiness, and by this year I mean actually last year, in which he gives a really wonderful performance as a down-on-his-luck man who becomes a stockbroker in the early 80s. I just think he's a wonderful guy, and he had to prove himself to me, but I'm glad he did.
Yeah, I liked him basically from the beginning, but I also have to agree that lately he's really been flexing his acting muscles, and I think it dates back about to Ali. He was Oscar-nominated for that film, and I think it took people by surprise. I think, it's not the Fresh Prince, is it? And, of course, he's gone back to some of those types of roles, but he does that personality really well. And then every once in a while, like with The Pursuit of Happiness or Ali, he'll just suddenly surprise you with something that's totally different. I like him quite a lot. My number six is Drew Barrymore, somebody who started out... I'm not even sure why I took such a dislike to her at first. I don't even know that I'd really seen a lot of stuff with her in it, and I thought, well, gosh, that's terrible. But since then, and you know, she does have a tendency to pick roles that are not very interesting. You know, they recycle her personality, and almost like with Will Smith, he picks too many that just recycle the same sort of personality. But... also, like Will Smith, I think she does a good job with that personality type, and then every once in a while she'll just pull something surprising and do something that's just a little different and makes you realize, yeah, she is quite the actress.
The last role I liked Drew Barrymore in was E.T. Moving on, my number five is Brad Pitt, who, when he first kind of burst onto the scene, I remember he was in that movie Legend of the Fall, which I hated. He you know, he's one of those sexiest men alive, and he didn't seem to be doing a whole lot except for, you know, kind of weird, stupid, easy roles that just played on his good looks, and I don't know, just something about him just bothered the heck out of me. And I have to say, when I saw 12 Monkeys, in which he gives a fantastic performance as a complete crazy guy, he looks kind of dirty and greasy and not at all attractive, I was like, okay, maybe this guy can act. And ever since then, Pitt just kind of alternates between those completely crazy nutso roles, think of him as Tyler Durden in Fight Club, and more cool, glamorous movie star roles. And something I like about him, he's got a real charm to him that I understand. Maybe I don't know exactly what it is I didn't like about him at first. Now it's hard for me to place my finger on it. Even when I go back and watch older Brad Pitt movies, I have to think that he does a good job. But I think definitely he's really matured as an actor, and he's constantly willing to take interesting roles, which is something I think that a good movie star is willing to do. They don't want to just play their same persona over and over, and Brad Pitt certainly has had a lot of range lately.
Yeah, I like Brad Pitt, too. The first time I remember seeing him and connected the name with the face and everything was in 12 Monkeys, and I thought that was amazing. And so I started out pretty much liking him, but as you were talking, I realized, actually, the first time I saw him, I hated him, and that was in Thelma and Louise, a movie I think is terribly overrated, but certainly his part in it is just, I think, just useless. And so I should have put him on my list, actually, but I didn't really know who he was at the time. Well, my number five... is a guy I'm still not sure if I like, but he's certainly been surprising to me in certain roles, and that is Will Ferrell, a Saturday Night Live alumnus, and like so many of them coming out of that show these days, that show is just terrible now. It's just awful, and the less said the better. But after making some really stupid comedies, he comes out with a movie called Elf, which really, really looked like another really stupid comedy, and I only saw it because I think it was Roger Ebert and a number of other critics were saying, hey, this is good. I'm quite, you know, it's sweet, it's funny and whatever. It's like, how can it possibly be anything but dumb? And I watched it, and it was pretty surprisingly good. And since then, I've seen him in things like Melinda and Melinda. Stranger Than Fiction I have not seen yet, but it looks very good. Certainly looks like he's playing a character that is not the total idiot, that he's actually doing something on the screen that is interesting. And so, you know, he still makes dumb movies, but I think he's got some good work in him, and I'm kind of surprised to be admitting that.
I agree with you that Saturday Night Live has not been funny in a long time, but when he was on it, I thought Will Ferrell was the best part of the show, and some of his movies are real guilty pleasures of mine. I mean, I love Anchorman, even though maybe I shouldn't. And I've always kind of liked Will Ferrell. I have a soft spot for him. But yeah, I think it's cool that he's doing these sort of, almost the Jim Carrey kind of route of moving into pseudo-serious comedies, which he can be funny, sort of like Carrey in The Truman Show, maybe. Well, my number four pick is Nicole Kidman, who I remember just sort of thinking for a long time, well, she's just Tom Cruise's wife, that's why she's in these movies, and it's hard to think of anything before the late 90s or so that Nicole Kidman in that's particularly impressive. I mean, I guess, you know, Far and Away has its supporters, but other than that, I don't really think of anything. I sort of thought, well, she's not really that interesting. And then, right around the time that she and Cruise broke up, suddenly she started acting in really interesting movies. She was in the last Stanley Kubrick film, Eyes Wide Shut, giving a wonderful performance in that underrated movie. And since then, great performances in The Others, in Moulin Rouge, even a movie like The Hours, which neither of us like that much, but which I think she gives a fantastic performance in. And now, of course, she's an acclaimed actress, and really, in a lot of ways, surpassed her ex-husband as a movie star and as an actor, especially. I mean, certainly, I think most people agree these days that Kidman is a better actor than Cruise is. And I don't know, exactly how it happened, you know, because like I said, during the 90s, she was in a lot of movies, but like, are you really going to remember her role in Batman Forever as a particularly fantastic turn? No, probably not. But these days, anytime I see a Nicole Kidman project, I'm interested in it just because of her. I think she's really dynamic, and she has a good choice in scripts lately as well.
Gosh, I couldn't, I agree with everything you said, and even just the little throwaway detail comments that you had, I agree with, so I'm not going to really say much more about her than that, but I didn't really start out disliking her either, so she missed my list. Number four for me is Johnny Depp, a guy from that I originally knew from 21 Jump Street, a show I never really saw too much, but what I saw I did not like. I thought it was just a sensationalistic garbage. And so my association with Johnny Depp was with that show, and then when I saw him in movies later on, or heard that he was in certain movies later on, I couldn't care less. I mean, that was a kind of a turnoff for me. But I saw him in Benny and June, and I saw him in What's Eating Gilbert Grape, and I thought, wow, this guy can act, and he's got some range to him. And sure enough, he's lived up to that ever since, and Donnie Brasco, and Pirates of the Caribbean, and I don't know, all the things he's different done. He never seems to repeat himself other than in the pirate sequels, I guess. But he's always different in every movie he makes, and that's just so interesting.
Yeah, Depp is great. I don't know that I ever disliked him, but I like him more and more as time goes on. He just continues to surprise me with his choices and roles. Well, my number three for me is a guy who kind of burst onto the scene also from television and then into movies with a big, huge debut that I despised, and that's George Clooney. I wasn't a big fan of ER when he was on that show, and he made Batman and Robin, which just was like a dagger into my heart as a guy who likes Batman a lot and just hated that film. And of course, Clooney has gone on to actually apologize profusely for that flick. Interesting, he was another one of his early big roles was in The Peacemaker, also with Nicole Kidman, not a particularly good movie. But interesting that both of them, I think, kind of goes to show how far they've come, that they've gone from these dumb action movies into actual quality roles. I think around the time I saw Clooney in Three Kings, I really, really appreciated him. And then, of course, he's gone on just to consistently make interesting movies and a lot of sort of low-budget independent films, or his interesting collaborations with Steven Soderbergh. I also really liked him in Out of Sight. I think probably Out of Sight and Three Kings were the two movies that convinced me Clooney is a guy I should watch. And now, I mean, if I have to pick a movie star, like a movie star to name as my favorite, a big star, Clooney's probably number one guy.
Wow, number one. I don't know if he's number one for me, but certainly up there, and I agree with what you...
I don't mean just in terms of actors. I mean in terms of, like, you know, movie star, that different breed of actor.
Yeah,
I think he's my favorite of the current stars.
Yeah, well, I agree with you. The turning point for me was Out of Sight in 98, and Three Kings, of course, 99, solidifies that. And I liked him in The Perfect Storm and Ocean's 11, and Good Night and Good Luck was a great movie that he directed as well as starred in. It was a very great performance there. What a turnaround. I started out... he's my number two, I'll say that right now. I just hated him at first. Not because I really had a reason to. It's just he was irritating. He looked cocky. He's got that annoying head wag thing. He's got this... it's like his neck's not really screwed on straight, so his head kind of wags back and forth in his early roles. And it's just one of those mannerisms that's sort of just annoying. And then he really started doing some great work that's quite fascinating, and especially as he's moving on into production and directing as well. Well, my number three also had this really annoying habit about him that he's sort of controlled, not really, but it's Hugh Grant, and his annoying trait was his stutter. He had this prissy little stutter about him in his early whimsical romantic roles, I guess, is early on in his career, and he's still playing them. But when I saw the movie Extreme Measures in 96, not a great movie, it's just okay, but it's a movie that needs him to play a more confident persona, and surprisingly, he really pulled it off, I think. And since then, like I say, he's still caught in this, looking a little too prissy, a little too affected. His mannerisms are a little too calculated, and you know he can't seem to get rid of those. But despite the limited range, I think he can play a lot better than he used to, and I think it was particularly good, for example, in About a Boy from 2002. So, an interesting guy to watch. I certainly don't hate him anymore.
Yeah, I can kind of see that. I think big star, kind of in the mid to late 90s, and playing that same character over and over, ever since Four Weddings and a Funeral. But yeah, I agree with you. It makes sense. My number two is actually a director, mainly, but he's a director who I started hating because of his acting. And that's going to surprise some people who know me, but that's Quentin Tarantino. And it took me a little while before I saw my first Tarantino movie, which actually I saw Jackie Brown first, which is kind of a screwy way to see them all. But I remember when he first kind of burst onto the scene with Pulp Fiction. That was, of course, a critically acclaimed movie that I didn't see at the time because it just didn't, I don't know, didn't seem that interesting to me. It seemed kind of overhyped. And then we started seeing Tarantino all over the place on television shows, in movies, and always as an actor. And he's not a good actor. And in interviews and stuff, he's the most annoying guy in the world. He rambles on and on and on. He talks really fast. And he just kind of sounds like this annoying little twerp. And I thought, there's no way this guy can be a good director. I don't know what the heck everyone's smoking, but those are not good movies. And then I saw Jackie Brown and thought, oh, that's a great movie. And then I saw Reservoir Dogs and Pulp Fiction and realized that I'd been wrong. But I still don't like Tarantino as an actor. I think his stuff in Reservoir Dogs is the weakest part of that movie. He's okay in Pulp Fiction, but glad that he stopped putting himself in his movies. And, you know, stuff from, like, From Dusk Till Dawn is not... That would be a better movie if Tarantino were not in it, I think.
You know, my first exposure to Tarantino was actually the movie Crimson Tide, where he doctored up the script for it. And I didn't know a whole lot about him. I hadn't seen him. I hadn't seen his movies. But I knew enough about him in the press, because he was all over the media at that time, that I knew what his style kind of was. So I watched Crimson Tide, and I thought, wow, this is a great movie. I still think it's a great movie. It's a very, very intense thriller. But this is one part where Denzel Washington is talking to somebody who's kind of lost his nerve and his ability to work. He needs to do something on a submarine, and he can't do it. And Denzel's saying, you need to be my Scotty. Like, talking about Star Trek. And I just thought that speech was the most condescending, stupid, you know, idiotic thing. And I was like, Tarantino wrote that part, didn't he? Ruined the script with that bit. And I just did not like that at all. And but later, as you say, I saw his movies and liked him in there. And then after I saw his movies, I saw him acting, and I thought, wow, he's really terrible. So I sure agree with you there. Anyway, my number two is George Clooney. We talked about it. So let's hear your number one.
Remember One is an interesting one, and something I kind of thought of late and when I was prepping this list. And remember how I mentioned that most of these guys are probably going to be people that we've seen recently, because you're not going to necessarily dislike classic actors? Well, I actually have one, and it's about me personally more than anything else. And when I grew up as a kid, my mom watched a lot of Westerns. She loved Westerns. And you know, when you're a kid, things that your parents really like tend to kind of annoy you. Well, for a long time, I didn't like John Wayne, because I'd seen so many John Wayne movies kind of against my will as a kid. And it's not until fairly recently that I've gone back and seen Wayne and realized, oh yeah, he's a fantastic actor in some just incredible movies. But yeah, I mean, for a long time, for no rational reason, mind you, it was just as a child, and like, I associated John Wayne with boring, old, slow movies that I hated. And now, of course, I love John Wayne, and I seek out Wayne movies and watch them. I think he's a tremendous actor who had real charisma and charm. And a lot of his movies, you know, a lot of them are kind of formulaic Westerns, but a lot of them also, especially his celebrated movies, really, really break the mold of the Westerns. I think of, say, The Searchers, or Yeah, well, I mean, mainly The Searchers, also like True Grit or stuff, where he really does interesting things with the Western genre.
Yeah, and The Shootist and the Cavalry trilogy from John Ford, She Wore a Yellow Ribbon, and all those. John Wayne is an easy actor to misunderstand because it looks like he's playing the same character over and over and over again, and that looks like bad acting. And it's not. It really isn't. If you really watch his movies, you really get a sense that he is not just a screen presence, but a really good actor. Yes, he's not versatile. I understand that. Neither was Cary Grant. But he is versatile in the sense of what kind of emotions can he portray. And he's very convincing in that, and very complex sometimes, too. Complex emotions. You wouldn't expect it from this guy who has an image of being this macho hero, and his two emotions are patriotism and you up. But he's got quite the emotional range that you would not expect. He's a very, very good actor. All right, my number one, we have mentioned him in passing. It is Jim Carrey. And when I first saw him when the Ace Ventura movies came out, I didn't see him on TV or anything, but I thought he was just annoying, obnoxious, and he has this expression, you just want to punch, if you know what I mean. I'm not a violent guy, and I wouldn't do it. But sometimes people have these really self-satisfied smirks, and you just want to punch them. And worst of all, you know, the guy is just not funny, at least, you know, in those earlier movies. I still don't think he's really that funny in those earlier movies. And Liar Liar came out, and it was one of these, it came out after The Mask and the two Ace Venturas, and I thought, you know, another one of these things, you know, he's not really doing anything different. And for some reason, I like that one. I don't know why. To this day, I don't know why I like that one and not the previous ones, because he's just as crazy and over the top and ridiculous, but maybe it was just getting used to him. But the real turning point, the point where I really started to respect him and admire him as an actor, is when he shifted gears and did The Truman Show and The Man on the Moon and The Majestic and Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind. And now, of course, we're a long way from The Truman Show, but he's actually a very, very good actor, certainly capable of a broad range, much broader than I ever would have imagined. He can do drama. I mean, Man on the Moon, especially, he does drama and comedy, and while completely embodying the persona of Andy Kaufman, which is, you know, that's a difficult impersonation to do, but it's just incredible.
Yeah, absolutely. Oh, I never had anything against Jim Carrey. I think Ace Ventura, at least the first one, is actually a pretty funny movie, and The Mask actually has its moments, too. So, and Dumb and Dumber is another guilty pleasure of mine that I really like. But yeah, I agree. I'm much happier with what he's doing today, though we don't necessarily see a whole lot of him. I think he's not one of those guys, kind of like Tarantino or somebody, that got oversaturated at first.
Yeah.
You saw too much of him. And I think that gets annoying. And so
after
that, I think kind of guys, you know, sort of burst onto the scene with a big hit, and we see way too much of them.
That's happening, I think, with Nicole Kidman now. I was going to mention it when you did, and I forgot. But Nicole Kidman, I think there's a lot of backlash now. And I don't think it's anything to do with her talent. It's just that she's in every movie.
Yeah, though it seems like she's kind of cooled it off a little bit lately. Especially, I mean, last year or two.
Yeah.
She's not in a ton of movies the way she was, seemingly, for a while. She was like, seemed like there are three Nicole Kidman movies every year for a little while.
Which I was happy with, frankly, but...
Yeah, me too, anyway. As long as they were good. I don't mind.
Yeah.
So let's go ahead and recap. My top six stars that I wasn't once fond of, but now am. Number six is Will Smith. Number five, Brad Pitt. Number four, Nicole Kidman. Number three, George Clooney. Number two, Quentin Tarantino. Number one, John Wayne, the Duke.
And my number six, Drew Barrymore. Number five, Will Ferrell. Number four, Johnny Depp. Number three, Hugh Grant. Number two, George Clooney. Number one, Jim Carrey. And if you have any ideas for us for future top six segments, let us know. Post on our website, allmovietalk.com. I can't guarantee we'll get to them. And if we do, it probably won't be very soon. You know, we do have a backlog that we have going, a couple months at least. But we would be interested in suggestions for more. This week's Film Spotlight is about a pretty unique movie. It sort of defies classification. It's called The Red Violin, and it was released in 1998. It's by a Canadian director named François Girard. Not someone I'm familiar with, actually. He hasn't done a lot of other movies. Probably the most recognizable other entry in his filmography is called 32 Short Films About Glenn Gould. I'm sure you haven't seen that. Anyway, the main character in The Red Violin is an inanimate object. It's supposedly a perfectly crafted violin with a uniquely reddish color to it, and it was crafted in Italy in 1681. And as the movie progresses, we keep coming back to this particular timeline and the story of the violin's creator and the creation of this violin. Meanwhile, we cross-cut with a timeline that occurs in the present day, which has Samuel L. Jackson as an attendee at an auction in Montreal. So we have these two storylines that unfold in parallel. And then there are all the stories in the middle, which follow the violin as it changes hands throughout history from 1681 to the present day. And the movie tells the stories of these people who possess this violin for a period of time. So we have this neat situation where we have flashbacks that also serve as flash forwards, depending on your point of reference. If it sounds confusing, it's not. The movie's structure is easy to follow, but the way it jumps through four centuries of history is pretty interesting. The three in-between stories here take place in an 18th century Austrian monastery, 19th century Oxford, and the 20th century Cultural Revolution in China. So we basically have a frame tale of sorts where the connections between the stories is this inanimate object, and this idea had been done a few times before, actually. Never to this effect, but, for example, in 1942 there was a pretty good movie called Tales of Manhattan, which followed a tailcoat as it changed from hands to hands. Less successfully, the 1993 film 20 Bucks followed a $20 bill through various transactions. But in The Red Violin, we have something that's more than just a gimmick or a cute way to link stories together. Somehow, this movie feels cohesive, like all the different stories are just pieces of a larger whole. Part of that is because whenever we fast forward back to the present day storyline, we discover that one of the stories that we've just told in the past has maybe told us something new about some of the characters that are attending this auction.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting the way that it works. Almost like a detective movie where you pick up new clues as the movie progresses, but, you know, of course, we're picking up these historical stories and getting clues about the present, and I think it's an interesting way that it's structured, like you said, but it's never hard to follow because we're constantly getting new information and things start making more and more sense as we go along.
Right. So, this is a movie that plays generally pretty quietly and subtly, taking its time to build an evocative atmosphere, but there's a wealth of diversity in this, so it doesn't ever really feel slow. There's a lot of surprises, passion, intrigue in this, a little bit of everything, really. For example, it hits quite a few different genres. There's romance, tragedy or two, a little bit of black comedy, and something else entirely when we learn a particular secret about the violin that I don't want to elaborate on. But there's even a little bit of action toward the end, because, you know, hey, why not? And there's a lot of different textures, too. I mean, we do actually spend time in five different countries and five different points in history, and each setting has its own feeling to it. This is a real multinational cast as well, and there are many languages spoken in this film. English, Italian, German, French, and Mandarin all have prominent uses in the movie. And a little bit of trivia, no other film had featured this many spoken languages since Jean Renoir's Grand Illusion in 1937. But as I said before, it still all feels cohesive, because all the different stories are rooted in the same basic themes. They're all about characters struggling to express their passions. One guy wants to be a great violinist and express himself through that. Another guy already is, but doesn't really know where to go from there. One woman has a passion that drives her that is dangerous to pursue because of the political situation at that time. The violin's creator, he's obsessed by making this violin, and he is also kind of obsessed with his wife, too, but he doesn't really understand maybe how to relate to her. And you'll have to find out for yourself why Samuel L. Jackson is at that auction. But these are all passions and drives that we can identify with, whether or not they're the same ones we have. I think most of us are driven by some kind of great inspiration and struggle with expressing that and perfecting that, so these stories really hit home.
And it's interesting the way that the stories work, because as you mentioned, they all sort of tie together, but at the same time, each one works more or less as a self-contained narrative. It's interesting that they can be so self-contained, but also tie so well into an overall structure. I don't know exactly how it manages to do it. The screenplay is brilliant in the way that it works, and I think it's also helped immensely by the production of the movie, which manages to tie together these different stories and disparate characters through a similar looks and create cinematography and really brilliant editing.
Yes, and I'd also like to talk about the music in this movie. I really only enough about music myself to know what I like. Definitely I love the violin music in this movie. It appears constantly throughout, and I understand for more musically inclined types that the music is really something special as well. Certainly, it just sounds beautifully pure, and I had no trouble believing this movie's premise that this particular violin is just so perfectly crafted and has such a special sound to it you don't get from other violins. More importantly, it really clinches the passions for music that so many of these characters have. You hear that absolutely gorgeous sound, and that in turn tells you something about the hearts of these characters. And there's also a bit of a surprise at the end, because maybe we'll figure out why this violin sounds good. It's not just that the creator was a good craftsman. Maybe there's something a little more to it. So that's sort of an interesting plot element at the end.
Yeah, there are a lot of interesting surprises. You wouldn't think that a movie about a violin would have all sorts of little subtle intrigues, but it sure manages to.
Yeah, and there's one last point I'd also like to make about this movie that I related to very personally, and that's something that, you know, I'm not an antique collector, but I've always been interested in seeing them from time to time, or go visit an antique shop where they have old farm tools or, you know, cooking implements or butter churners, all that kind of stuff that's relics from a past way of life. Because they really trigger my imagination, and I start to wonder what kind of things these old instruments or whatever, what these things have been through and what the people who owned them were like and how they lived their lives and how these things came to be in the places and conditions they are now. Well, there's a moment in The Red Violin where a present-day restorer looks at a spot of damage on this violin and he scoffs at this old-fashioned repair attempt and wonders how he'll restore it properly. This happens all the time if you own anything old. You go to yard sales or whatever, you go to antique shops. Things accrue wear and damage over time, but you never really know how it got there. It's just, well, there's this damaged corner here on this thing, whatever, we'll fix it. Or maybe this other guy, he did it, he made a mistake, he stripped all the paint, and this thing is worth more with the paint on it, whatever. Well, earlier in this movie, we actually not only saw how this violin got that damage centuries ago, we also saw that initial repair job that was being scoffed at by the present-day guy. These things all take place at very disparate parts in time, but we see all three of these events. Now think about that for a moment. How often does anyone get to see that much of the big picture? This movie gives you a really privileged view that we don't normally ever see.
Yeah, it's sort of the wonderful things about movies that they're able to show us so much of something, to move between characters and places and times and let us know things we shouldn't know if it were real life. I think something worth mentioning is the discussion about this movie may sound a little stodgier and stiffer than it actually is. And you think, oh, here's a movie that takes place over four centuries and features 15,000 languages. That's going to be pretty dull. It's actually not. It's a very moving, swift-moving film that, while it takes the time to build up its emotional resonance and power, is never dull, even for a second. I don't really have any interest in antiques or violins or that, but I was absolutely gripped by every moment of the film.
I do think it will be slow for certain people at certain times. And, you know, a couple of the stories are not as strong as a couple of the others. So if you're expecting something fast and loud or whatever, you know, it may not do it for you. But,
Sam,
as Steven says...
Sam, I don't think anyone watching a movie called The Red Violin is expecting an action-packed... action-packed whiz-bang type of
flick. Well, what's funny is we even do get a little bit of that at the end. It's just interesting that this movie kind of surprises you with its content. But definitely, if you are willing to flow with what this movie has to show you, it's just amazing. I mean, it's fresh, it's vibrant, it's really absorbing. I was pretty much entranced the whole time by this movie. Well, if you remember way back at the beginning of this episode, we had a trivia question about the Sorcerer's Apprentice from Fantasia. Walt Disney wanted to use Mickey Mouse as the primary character in that segment, but the original writer had a different idea, wanted to use a different famous Disney character. Steven, do you know which one that would be?
Is it Donald Duck?
It is not Donald Duck. That's a good guess, though, because he did reappear later in Fantasia 2000 playing Noah. But no, it's one of the Seven Dwarfs. Give you one guess out of seven here.
Dopey?
Dopey is right, yes. The names of the dwarfs are, of course, Happy, Sleepy, Sneezy, Bashful, Grumpy, Dopey, and Doc. But there's a pool of about 50 candidates, including Awful, Biggie, Blabby, Dirty, Gabby, Gaspy, Gloomy, Hoppy, Hotsy, Jaunty, Jumpy, Nifty, Shifty, and Snoopy. Dopey was one of the last to be decided on of the seven. Walt Disney wanted it, but many of the animators weren't so thrilled with that. They said it was too modern-sounding to appear in a fairy tale. Well, Disney's counter-argument to that was that, hey, Shakespeare used the word dopey in one of his plays, so it can't be all that modern a word. So dopey it was, and since then, nobody has ever found a use of the word dopey in any of Shakespeare's work.
Well, that's about it for this week, but be sure and check out the website, allmovietalk.com, where we'll post all of our top six lists. We have show notes giving more detail and links to information about each episode and all the segments that we do, and just lots of other good movie-related discussion during the week. We update it regularly, so, you know, check back every weekday and see something new.
And also check out rinkworks.com, the premier entertainment site for things that I have put on the web myself, and including more stuff about movies. Next week, we got episode 26, and we're going to continue talking about animation, specifically how we get animation, how it's done. We'll talk about Adventure on the High Seas and do another Factor Fiction. And our top six list is Guilty Pleasures, movies that we think are bad but like anyway and probably shouldn't, and we're completely guilty for liking them. So check back next week on March 27th for episode 26.